Good evening and welcome to this first presentation in our 15th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague, Peggy Wright, who's recovering from hip surgery today, and with help from our webmaster, Hai Wong Wan, doing double duty here. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melky. Our speaker tonight is a native of Columbus, Ohio, where she and her husband have lived in or near St. Louis for the last 35 years. She attended schools in the Columbus suburb of Upper Arlington, where she decided in the fifth grade she wanted to be a writer. She says her writing was most influenced by Eudora Welty, Annie Dillard, and Lauren Isley. She majored in journalism and psychology at Syracuse University before attending graduate school in Goucher College in Towson, Maryland, from where she received an MFA in creative nonfiction. Her writings in creative nonfiction have appeared in SNR Review, Damselfly Press, National Gardening, Horticulture, American Nurseryman, and many newspapers. She became a member of Rotary International in 2005, and as a humanitarian activist, has visited Niger, Nigeria, Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda. While giving a lecture about her work in Africa at the Rotary Club of St. Charles, Missouri, she met a fascinating woman, Anna Amouge, who asked the author how she could get 54 mosquito nets to an orphanage in Uganda. Their friendship led to the publication of Kate's new book, The Moon in Your Sky, An Immigrant's Journey Home, which was published in 2014 by the University of Missouri Press. Kate was the 2013-2014 Rotary International Governor for Eastern Missouri. When not traveling or writing, Kate enjoys playing with her four grandsons and taking bicycle trips. Please give a warm welcome to Kate Sallard. Kate?
Thank you, Brian. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about this wonderful woman that I have the honor of having written about. And just to give you a little background to explain why, I'm not the most likely individual to have written a biography of a woman from Uganda, so I wanted to explain a little bit how that came about. Through Rotary International, I've worked in Africa in many different roles. Rotary International is a service organization that is located in over 200 countries, and we do humanitarian work wherever the work is needed, and everything we do is a grassroots effort. We put money into humanitarian efforts, but we only do it when Rotarians from a local community tell us that there is a need there. So we're not an organization that goes off someplace and says, I know what you need and I'm just going to bring it over here and put it right there and you're going to figure out how to use it. What we do is wait until we hear what is needed. Almost 30 years ago, Rotary discovered, well actually it was a little over 30 years ago, through one of those projects in the Philippines, Rotary discovered that we could eradicate polio in the entire country of the Philippines through massive immunizations. After doing that, Rotarians got to thinking about that and they said, well, if we can do it in one country, why can't we do it in the world? And so for the past 30 years, Rotary has been eradicating polio. It's proven a long effort. We're not quite there yet, but in 1985, when we agreed that we would begin this effort, there were 1,000 children in the world coming down with polio every day. This year, to date, the 9 months of this year, there have been 171 new cases of polio in the entire world. So we are almost there, and we will complete this. We have, polio is now endemic in only 3 countries in the world. One of them is Nigeria, and I traveled to Nigeria several times, immunizing children. And what's interesting about those immunization trips is that we as Americans go there to help, but it's really the local Rotarians in partnership with local health workers who are doing the immunizing. We're there mainly to attract crowds, which is exactly what happens, as you can see. The kids all come to get a look at these strange people, and then while they're there, we just say, well, open your mouth. I'm going to put some drops in your mouth. What we use is the oral vaccine, so we use the drops. We do that partly because anybody can do it, and also partly because it is the most efficient way to get immunizations to massive numbers. When we do these immunization trips, we are immunizing in regions. They aren't just national efforts, they're regional efforts. This trip to Nigeria was a sub-Saharan trip, and we immunized over 1 million children over a 3-day period in that area. So these are massive immunization efforts. It's a simple job of dropping drops into the child's mouth. 2 drops will immunize them, and they're good to go. One of the most rewarding things for me is the children, and I take the opportunity to hold as many children as I possibly can. They're beautiful children, and they deserve all of the possibility in life that children in this country deserve, and so that's why we're there immunizing them. On one trip to the country of Niger, which is the poorest country in the world according to the UN Developmental Index, we were again immunizing children against polio, but what we realized was that while it's important to remove polio as a threat to these children, it is not their most dire need. They have much simpler, more basic needs, and that is water. The one river in the country of Niger is the Niger River, and it is where they bathe, they wash their dishes, they wash their clothes, they bring their animals to drink, and then they bring the water back and their children drink it, and they drink it as well. Actually, in Niger, if you live near enough to that river, you're very lucky. Because it is the only water source, most of the young women in the country of Niger are never educated. They spend their days trying to find water, walking to get the water, bringing it back to their families, helping their mother prepare food, and so on. And so water becomes a problem in so many different ways. It brings disease, it deprives them of education. For those that aren't lucky enough to live within walking distance of the Niger River, they dig pit wells. And that darkness in the bottom there, that's not just darkness, that's the water. The water, I was told one time by one of the children that sometimes the water smells so bad, they have to wait until they're very, very thirsty before they can drink it, because they have to overcome the fact that it smells so bad. So what we learned was that we need to address this problem as well. We did some considerable research, and we discovered that the water table in this part of Niger is really very high. We could actually provide a well that gives them pure, clear, clean water. It's a filtered well, and it costs $2,000. $2,000. And we provide water for about 500 individuals in a small village. The most interesting part is when we put the well in, the children won't drink the water at first. They're afraid of it because they've never seen clear water. They don't understand what that stuff is. So we have to convince them that it's really okay to drink the water. I've also been traveling in other parts of Africa. This is in Tanzania, where we put mosquito netting for orphanages throughout Tanzania and parts of Kenya. And the threat of malaria, of course, is a big problem for people there. So it's very exciting to be able to come in and at least tell these children that you won't suffer from malaria, or at least we can help prevent that by putting in mosquito netting. And of course, before we leave, we have to give the kids some toys and presents. They're always very excited. And we brought them hats because it's so hot and sunny there. So it's always about the children. It's just a wonderful life. So that takes us then across the country to Uganda. And as Brian said, I did meet Anna Emuge through Rotary. Her story was one that I just had to tell as soon as I heard it. there is Uganda. Uganda is about the size, it's a little bit smaller than Oregon, so it's not a large country. It is landlocked, however, it's on it's on Lake Victoria. It is also where the headwaters of the Nile exist. So it's a beautiful country. It is a small population. They have two rainy seasons. It's a difficult place to live, but this is where Anna Emuge grew up. People there live basically, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know my slide would do that. That was quite fancy. Wow, you never know what technology is going to do for you. Anna grew up in Agu village, which is pointed out there on the kind of in the eastern part of Uganda. And everyone there grew up in mud huts. So that brings us to the story of Anna Emuge, and I'd like to just read you a little bit from the book about how her story begins. On nights when the vast Ugandan sky poured moonlight into every corner of his family compound, Christopher liked to sit in the doorway of his hut after Esther and the girls had gone to sleep and look in at his son. He pictured all that he would teach little Francis, how to urge the goats and cows to the river with shouts and soft swats, how to cut the stunted trees into branched poles for the animal pen fence, how to manage this patch of scratchy land that had been his family's possession for scores of generations. Sometimes, when Esther turned in her sleep, he was sure he could see the outline of his boy forming strength and character inside her. "It is a girl," Esther would say to him when she saw him glancing at her belly during the daytime. "See how she lies curled on my side, just like Rosemary and Magdalene. She is Anna." "It's a boy," he would mutter, never letting her see the doubt. "It's time you gave me a son, and this is Francis." After all, he knew when he married her that Esther was a good woman. She surely was capable of producing a male child. After the first girl, when his parents had urged him to take a second wife, he had been quick to defend her. "Esther Atai has many good ancestors, and she's named for one of the best, a mother to many sons and grandmother to village elders and wealthy men. Didn't Esther's own mother have three strong sons?" When Esther had born a second daughter, he let them bring in Lucy. But what good did a second wife do? She bore no sons either. Sometimes he worried that he had brought bad luck on himself by marrying Lucy, but surely now his luck was changing. His Esther, his first true wife, would bear him a son this time. Every look at her swollen belly reassured him. Sometimes the tiny creature inside would stretch out an arm or leg, poking a foot or hand at him from its fleshy cage. Those were the long, strong limbs of a boy, and this was the impatience of a boy, unable to leave the women behind and go with his father through the day's tasks. Often now, when Christopher was out with the cows and goats at the river, he would speak softly to Francis, imagining how he would teach him. "We never use sticks on the animals, Francis," he would say. "A swat or a shout is enough to move a goat or cow, and the meat is more tender when they haven't been beaten. Keep your eyes open wide, my son. If even one strays to the neighbor's field and eats his crops, we will be fined severely and embarrassed before the village." It was around mid-morning on a Friday when a woman from the village came to tell him that Esther was going to the hospital in town. "It is too early and she has great pain," the woman said. "She must begin the journey now before it is too late." Christopher looked out beyond the fields and watched his wife walk stiffly down the path that would take her the 12 miles to the midwife. Birthing children was no business for him, and he knew there would be women to help if she needed it. Someone had undoubtedly already run to alert Esther's mother that she must go to the hospital with food and supplies. Christopher sent a silent message to his son to persevere in spite of his early birth. On Saturday, September 19th, 1959, weighing less than 6 pounds, Anna became the smallest live baby ever to be born in the small mission medical facility called Fredica Hospital near Mora Township. She was named for the nun who had checked Esther's health each month during the pregnancy and who now cared for the two of them for 5 days. The day after Anna's birth, the news of her arrival was relayed to Christopher. The birth of a daughter certainly wasn't enough reason for a man to travel 24 miles, so the introduction of the tiny girl to her father didn't occur until a week after he had watched his wife leave for her journey, expecting her to return with his son. Christopher was told on Friday afternoon that his wife and baby had arrived home. Near nightfall, when he had finished his day's activities, he went to the doorway of his hut and looked in on Esther, who lay on her bedding with a small bundle at her breast. She rose and brought the child to him, a look of mingled fear and pride on her face. Christopher was a gentle man, so he offered no reproach, but merely leaned down from his height of well over 6 feet to get a look at the child. "Your little Anna has a fighter's spirit, Christopher, and look at those long arms and legs. She'll be a good, strong girl." His mother spoke from behind him, where she had come to stand when she saw him striding toward the hut. He felt a stab of pride in spite of himself, and then caught his breath when he glanced at the baby's eyes. Her dark eyes seemed to be regarding him with an even, direct look. Startled, he stared into her eyes for several moments, remembering the little boy he thought he had known all those months. His tiny daughter returned his gaze steadily. "Anna Frances Achum," he said. He gave a curt nod to Esther, and she turned, smiling, back into the hut to nurse her baby. That middle name meant that he loved his daughter in spite of his wishes for a boy, and by giving her the ancestral name of Achum, Christopher had bestowed on Anna the name of a beloved and revered female family member. So from that day forward, she was Anna to her mother, whom she called Toto, but she was Frances to her papa. She went by both names for all of her life. Her childhood was a pretty ordinary one for a child in a village in those days. She helped her mother go for the water. She helped with the chores. She helped in the field, tilling the field, doing the cooking, and so on. But there was one big difference in Anna's life, and that was that Toto was absolutely determined that her daughters would be educated, that they would get out into the real world and not just be village women. Now, that was a pretty easy thing to do for the first 2 years because there was a village school in Agu. After that, Anna had to go to a school that was 7 miles away. It was a boarding school, but it also took day students, and Anna's family could not afford to pay the fees to have her board there, so she walked 7 miles to school and 7 miles home every day. Actually, she ran. Although the distance to and from school was hard on the children from Agu, Anna came to love these treks. She used the trip to practice running, and she became the fastest girl in her class. She loved the feel of the wind rushing through her short hair and swirling her uniform skirt around her legs. No one in the family except Toto and Papa had ever had shoes, but the soles of Anna's feet never even felt the sticks and stones that she pushed into the earth under them as she ran down the paths. Anna's runs through the early mornings were pure joy for her, with birds twittering around her and the grass and trees glowing in the rising sun. Her feet kicked up small clouds of the orange-brown earth, and she could hear the rhythmic slap of her soles on the soft dirt. On those days, Anna felt as if she could just keep running forever, maybe even to Kenya. But of course, her only goal was to reach school and continue her learning. One rainy day in April of her fifth grade year, Toto gave Anna the money for school fees and lectured her on the importance of taking the money directly to the headmistress and bringing back a receipt. Anna knew how hard Toto worked to sell produce, milk, and even the beer she brewed just to keep Anna in school. Sometimes when she was very hungry at school, she reminded herself that her mother gave up meals and many other things to be sure that her daughter would get an education. So that day she ran all the way with her head down and the cloth that held the money firmly clasped against her chest. When she arrived, she went to Sister Nicodem and paid her fees proudly, waiting patient while her teacher wrote out the receipt. When school let out, it was still pouring rain, and Anna carefully wrapped the receipt in the cloth that had carried the money and held it against her as she ran home. However, the cloth was soaked, and the receipt that she had wrapped up so carefully was unreadable. "We won't worry," Toto said. "Sister Nicodem is a careful person, and I'm sure she recorded our payment correctly." Anna noticed the wrinkles across Toto's forehead and knew, though, that there would be no way to make up this money if the school should mistakenly ask for it again. Anna slowly lost her worry over the ruined receipt, but one day in May, Sister Nicodem took Anna into her office to tell her she could not continue at school until the fees were paid. I paid them in April, Anna stammered, knowing what was coming. I don't have a record of that, but if you're sure, then just bring me the receipt tomorrow. The tears began to pour down Anna's cheeks at this. The money had been paid, and Toto had no more. Oh, sister, I did pay you. Remember, I stood right here in the office and you gave me the receipt. But it was raining that day and the paper got all wet and I gave it to Toto, but there was no writing on it. Anna was crying so hard that Sister Nicodem took her to a chair and patted her while she calmed down. I will let you stay today then, Anna, but I have no record that you paid. Tomorrow you must bring me those fees. She walked home slowly that day, sobbing softly to herself as she went. When she told her mother of the problem, Toto became angry and said she would go and speak with Sister Nicodem tomorrow. Anna worried all night. What if Toto makes Sister angry and I can never go to school again, she thought. It seemed as if she could feel the world crowding in around her, taking away all the freedom and promise that her schooling had given her. The next morning, Magdalene awoke with a cough, and Toto needed to stay home with her. Toto said she would go to the school with Anna the next day if Magdalene felt better. Anna decided that she would go to school by herself that day because she had paid the fees and she belonged at school. All the way to school, she practiced telling Sister that she knew she had paid, but the moment she entered the compound, she became scared and wished she had stayed home. Frances, Sister Nicodem was calling to her from the doorway, waving a piece of paper. Anna knew immediately what it was. I found the record. You did pay your fees in April. Everything is fine. Then Anna and the headmistress both entered the building with huge smiles on their faces. Anna was still smiling that evening when she arrived home, and Toto knew immediately that the problem must have been solved. As she told her mother the story of the found record, her elation was replaced by a new realization. She was just one small girl on this enormous planet, and nothing in that world would change if she suddenly could not attend school. Only Anna and Toto would suffer. Anna's life would be hard and sad instead of the exciting, important one her mother had described to her. And Toto would have worked all these years to educate Anna only to see her dreams for her daughter ruined, like so many of the crops she had toiled in the blistering sun to tend when God sent no water to sustain them. Never again would Anna stride into the sunlight expecting the world to give her what she sought. Like her mother and all of her women ancestors, Anna would face each day with one shoulder lifted slightly to ward off the blows that life could deliver suddenly and cruelly. I have to tell you that this was an important story in Anna's life to me because, frankly, it was about the worst thing that happened to her when she was in school, and that is miraculous. Because just about this time, Idi Amin Dada, a general in the army, overthrew the president and took over the presidency of Uganda. Idi Amin is a name that's synonymous even today with cruel, egomaniacal dictatorship, and that is exactly what it was. Uganda at that time was rife with soldiers going through villages, looting, raping, killing. killing. They especially like to attack schools. And yet somehow Anna made it through all of her schooling without ever being touched by a soldier. It was a difficult time, and yet it was a time when Anna thrived. She went through school, she got her dream job, she became a nursing intern at a small clinic in Olio. She worked there for a couple years, and during that time the threats from the soldiers became worse and worse. It got to the point where people would finish their work, and instead of going home, because the soldiers raided in the evening and in the night, instead of going home to their huts, they would go out into the bush and sleep under trees, hiding from the soldiers. Every day, that was their life. They would finish work, they would get what food they could find, take it out to the bush and eat it, and then try to sleep there. And yet, in the midst of all that, Anna met a young man named James Emugé, who was a brilliant young teacher. Love bloomed under these trees, hiding from the soldiers. They managed to overcome all of these threats. They ended up getting married just after Idi Amin had been overthrown. After about a year, they had their first child. Gilbert was born. And Anna and James moved to Amuria in the north, which was where James's mother lived, and she was a widow, so they moved there to be closer to James's mother. During that time, Milton Obote became the president again of Uganda, and things were quieter, but there was still massive starvation, deprivation. The country had been devastated by the soldiers, and it did not recover quickly. So there was famine, there was hunger, there were tribal animosities that were just worsened by all of the suffering that was going on. And so life was not that much easier in Amuria. Their district of Teso was bordered on the northeast by the Karamojong district. It was through this area that Idi Amin and his soldiers had fled. And this was also the district where the Teso people's bitterest enemies resided. The Karamojong felt that all cattle in the area belonged to them ancestrally, and they had raided Teso farms for years. But it soon became clear that there was a new twist to this age-old hatred. Hosting Idi Amin and his followers had left the Karamojong armed with rifles, while the Tesos still protected themselves with knives and spears. By May, there were so many raids on homes in the evening hours that Anna found herself once again hiding in bushes, but this time she also had to shield her small son from the horror. She and James would sit numb under the low trees, not daring to speak a word for fear of rousing Gilbert. A cry from him could bring the evil raiders to their hiding place, and Anna wouldn't let herself think what would happen then. One night, as Anna sat under the bushes, she began to review her life. How much death and fear had she seen in her 20 years on earth? How much more could she take? She never questioned God's willingness to care for her, but why was he content with the suffering that was once again the way of life in Uganda? Things were better. President Obote had returned to power and the government was maintaining peace in some areas near Kampala, the capital. Even Agu was peaceful and regaining some prosperity, but here she sat in hiding from her own countrymen while the government did nothing. Just then, Gilbert awoke with a whimper, and James reached over and pulled the baby onto his lap. By this time, Gilbert was almost a year old and walking, so it was all they could do to keep him from toddling out of the bushes to find adventure. It was a night with a bright, almost full moon, and she could see their profiles against the silent sky. James leaned down and whispered in Gilbert's ear, and then the two of them began drawing with their fingers in the dirt. She watched as Gilbert would carefully study the shapes that his father had created in the dust, and then add his own little squiggles. Finger to his lips, James would nod approval and then elaborate the picture so that Gilbert would want to add to it again. The two of them worked at their art for over half an hour, with James deftly directing Gilbert's attention back when it began to wander. Seeing this father-son game played in absolute silence, but seeming to shout to Anna about their love for each other, she realized with a grateful sigh that this man, and now also his small son, truly were her destiny in life, no matter how terrible the world around them might become. A sense of ferocity settled over her when she thought of the forces that threatened to harm these two, and she knew she would give up her own life in an instant to protect either one of them. It's a good thing that Anna had that kind of strength, because life got more difficult for her, not less. James was offered an opportunity to move into an inspectorship for the schools, and so they moved away from the north, away from the Karamojong, and things were better. But then the government began to be threatened, and once again it was a fight between the north and the south, basically. Milton Obote, the president in office, was from the north, and he identified James, her husband, as a young man with great promise, decided that James would be the next minister of education for Uganda, and offered them an opportunity to go to the U.S. and where he could get a PhD in education. As they were preparing to leave for the U.S., things got worse in Uganda. There was more fighting, more tribal animosity, and they felt that they really got out of Uganda just in time, because they were in the south and they were from the north, and it was becoming difficult for them. But they arrived at Ohio University with two children. James began his studies. The U.S. was a wonderful place to Anna and to James. They were so excited to be here. And then the government was overthrown. Milton Obote was taken from power, people in the South took over, and that meant that James's scholarship disappeared. Not only that, but because they were from the North, they could not go back to Uganda, even if they'd had the money to do it. If they had returned to Uganda, James would have been killed, Anna would have been either imprisoned or killed, because they were friends of the deposed president. And so they were stranded in the U.S. They were not able to get visas that permitted them to work except for three-month periods, and so James was not able to get a teaching job. By that time, they had four children, and they raised the four children working in fast food restaurants, working at McDonald's. This was devastating to James. He had been a proud, intelligent, successful man in Uganda, taking care of his family, helping millions of children, and teaching just exactly what he wanted to be doing. And suddenly, he was working as a fry cook in a restaurant. He became an alcoholic. His presence in the family became sporadic when he was there. Sometimes he was violent. Anna was facing even more devastating problems than Idi Amin, which is supposed to be the definition of the most horrible existence you could imagine. But remember, this is Toto's daughter, and so Anna rose to this occasion too. One occurrence in their life after James was really kind of not there very much. They had a car, but James was the only person who could drive it, because women didn't really learn to drive in Uganda. And James would take the car and go and be gone for weeks at a time. And so Anna would run to McDonald's, and then she would run back home. Fortunately, she had the background to do that. So she would run to her job and run home and take care of the four children. And she noticed one day that a neighbor had a car for sale, and she just walked over to the neighbor and said, "I want to buy the car." Of course, she didn't know how to drive the car, so there was an interesting exchange where she had to ask the man to drive the car over to her driveway, because she couldn't drive. So he drove the car to her driveway, and she pulled up, and let me find for you. Once the car was parked in the driveway, Anna got some rags and wiped down the seats and the dashboard. Then she sat in the driver's seat looking at all the knobs and switches, carefully comparing them to the owner's manual. Something caught her eye, and she looked out the side window to see her four children all standing in the yard, their mouths open. She got out and said, "Well, how do you like my car?" "Mommy, you can't drive," they shouted. Anna just laughed and told them she was sure she could learn. The kids played outside for the rest of the afternoon, but Anna noticed that they stayed far away from the car, as if it were an alien being. That night, after she had put Brian to bed, Anna told the older kids to stay in the house while she went out to drive the car. Over Gilbert's worried protests, she settled them in the living room and went out and turned the key in the ignition. The engine roared to life. She eased into the street, put the car in drive, and turned the steering wheel. Just before accelerating, she noticed the faces of her three children pressed against the front window pane. She gave them a cheery wave and drove slowly up the street, starting and stopping as she went. Her hands were sweaty and her heart was pounding, but she managed to drive the 8 miles to her McDonald's. She pulled into the parking lot and resisted the urge to let out a triumphant whoop. She could do this. When she got back to the house, the kids were still peering out the window, and she was sure they hadn't moved. As she walked in the front door, Diana burst into tears, and Gilbert chided, "Mom, we thought you would get in an accident and die." The next day, Anna left 2 hours early and drove, tight-lipped and terrified, to work. "God, I am sick and tired of James controlling my life when I can't count on him," she prayed as she sat in the car. "I know I'm breaking the law, but is there any way you could just protect me while I do this?" Over the next week, Anna managed to learn to drive to and from work without sweating so much that she had to stand outside in the cool air to dry off before entering McDonald's. She stayed off the highway, and the narrow streets with parked cars on both sides terrified her, but she refused to be afraid and continued driving. Her next hurdle came when she realized she needed to put gas in the car. She pulled in at a gas station on the way home from work and located the gas tank door, but she couldn't figure out how to get the pump going. She read everything written on the pump, but it left her no closer to seeing how to do this. Finally, she drove home and asked Gilbert if he would like to come with her to the gas station and she would buy him some candy. Once they pulled up to the pump, Anna casually asked Gilbert to pump the gas, as he did with his dad sometimes. Gilbert got out and effortlessly negotiated the operation of the pump while Anna studied his every move. When they went in to pay for the gas, she happily bought him a candy bar and a soda. The car became the place where Anna talked to God. She noticed that she no longer asked things of him. She would just say something like, "God, there's a policeman behind me. You know I don't have a license and I can't pay a big fine. Make him go away now." It seemed that on most days, God did what she told him to do. So Anna's life was extremely difficult. It became more and more so, but Anna overcame. She raised her four children. She earned a bachelor's degree and an MBA. But most importantly, what she had to do was acquire U.S. citizenship. And the reason she needed the citizenship was she could not return to Uganda until she was a citizen of the United States. Finally, in 2004, she did return to Uganda. It took her that long. And if I have, I'll just read you a quick passage about her trip there. During the week before her flight, Anna collected all the clothing, mostly for children, that she could stuff into her two allotted suitcases, along with some basic first aid items. She packed barely anything for herself, knowing how quickly clothing dried in the Ugandan sun after being washed in the river. She emailed her nephew George with her flight arrival time, and he replied that he would be there to pick her up. "Your mother will be with me," he wrote. "She says she must see the machine that brings her child from America." Anna could imagine how he had tried to convince Toto not to make such an arduous bus journey when he would bring Anna to Agu immediately, and she knew exactly how Toto had looked at him and then informed him that her mind was made up. The trip took her first to New York to change planes and then to Rome, so she was tired and a little disoriented by the time she got on the plane to Africa. Anna watched the map in front of the plane, and as soon as the little airplane icon arced over the continent, she began to cry. Passengers near her and the flight attendants asked if she was okay, and she kept reassuring them she was just emotional about going home. Soon a large portion of the plane knew some of her story, that she would see her parents for the first time in 22 years. So people constantly stopped to congratulate her and wish her a happy reunion. The plane bumped down on the runway, and Anna watched the airport getting closer, thinking it looked exactly the same as in 1983 when she had watched it receding and held her breath until she was out of Uganda. This time she wanted to kneel and kiss the ground that she had fled from the last time she touched it. In the customs area, some people looked at her with curiosity when she got in the line for foreign passports instead of the one for Ugandan citizens. She tried not to show how her heart was pounding as she handed her passport to the official, whose uniform brought waves of nauseating, terrifying memories to her. He barely looked at her, stamped the page, and handed the passport back, mumbling, "Enjoy your stay in Uganda," as she took it and walked through the gate. Baggage lay on the large expanse of the concrete floor, and she quickly picked up her two large suitcases and dragged them to the door. A few porters were eagerly pushing carts up to the few white passengers who'd been in the passport line with her just minutes ago, but they all acted like she was invisible. Anna walked through the gate past families and individuals lined up with welcoming smiles and signs. She scanned the crowd eagerly, but George was not there. She made her way into the midday heat and stood near the taxi, searching the road for George. After half an hour, a car pulled up just across the road from her, and she saw George step out. Then Toto got out on the far side of the car, and Anna ran toward her. Toto ran too, and they met in each other's arms behind the car. Anna was vaguely aware that George had sprinted toward her bags, and she realized how risky it was to leave bags here even for a second. But it didn't matter, because she was hugging her mother, and Toto's strong arms were around her again. "Let me see," Toto was saying after several moments. "I must see your eyes." "Yes, that's my baby," she said, holding Anna's face in her hands. "Don't cry anymore, my girl. I'm here. I'm here." Anna felt cradled and safe at last. How she had longed for just this moment. So she did make it back to her village of Agu. And what she found when she arrived was that her parents were taking care of 15 orphans. These were children who had lost their parents in the tribal wars and also to HIV/AIDS, which had swept through Uganda in the late 1990s. And so there were her elderly mother and father, having survived refugee camps and returned to Ago, rebuilt their home, and now they were taking care of orphans. So Anna quickly began working to support these orphans. She came back to this country and she started a 501c3 and began raising money to take care of the orphans. The orphanage grew to 54, and that's when I met Anna, who said without any preamble, "Can you get me 54 mosquito nets?" And you see now why she did it that way. And you don't say no to Anna, so that's what we did. But this is Anna in 2009 at the orphanage. She's standing there in her family compound. The orphans are gathered around, and so are most of the villagers of Agu, because for one of their own to come back from America and help them was a pretty exciting thing. So they were all gathered around. Even in 2009, and I was fortunate enough to accompany Anna on this trip, so I could see the orphanage myself. And even in 2009, life there was pretty much the way it had been when Anna left. The women cooked outside on a wood fire, and they fed the children. And those 54 orphans, when they lined up, turned into more like 100, because throughout the village, there were children living with very elderly grandparents. Their parents had died. They weren't full-fledged orphans, but they didn't have enough food at home, and they knew they could get food at a Thai orphanage, so there would be 100 kids to feed every time it was mealtime. Anna has been able to take care of the kids. She always brings them gifts, and they're excited just to have pencils, and they always dole them out very carefully. Everybody gets the same number of pencils. She brings them toys. She brought them soccer balls, and we were surprised that she wanted soccer balls until we got there, and we traded them, our soccer balls, for their soccer ball. And this is the soccer ball that they were using. When Anna was a girl, it was banana leaves, so it had improved a little from there. I'll let you pass this around. Promise no headbutts. There you go. Kids will be kids anywhere, and they play no matter what. They were very good at soccer. We asked them if they played, and they said, of course we play, and then they brought out that ball, so we were pretty impressed. Anna has been able to educate every one of those orphans who needed education. And in Uganda, school is only free up to the sixth grade, and then you must pay. So Anna is paying for these children. She has nine children in high school. She has four in university. And there are a few who have graduated from nursing training or universities and are now functioning adults. After our visit, during our visit in 2009, one of the things we did that I did through Rotary, I found a Rotary club nearby, Rotary's everywhere, and we had a well put in. And you know, you don't just turn money over to somebody in Uganda and say, we have to leave now, but would you dig a well for these people? So we turned it over to the Rotary Club, and this is the well that was dug. It's a 240-foot borehole well. It serves 2,000 people, which means the whole village has clean water now. The kids are just amazed by the clean water. And I want to tell you just a quick story. I don't know if you read, but all of the royalties from this book go directly to Anna for the orphans. I certainly am not being paid to have written this book. I'm just so fortunate to have been able to tell this story and help these people. But I want to show you this very dramatic effect of just bringing clean water to a village. When we were there in 2009, this woman brought her child, and the woman's name, she said, was Debbie. And we asked her what her little girl's name was, and she said, oh, my daughter's name is Anna Frances Acham. We said, wow, why did you name your daughter for Anna? They call her Mama Frances, so we said, why did you name your daughter for Mama Frances? And she said, because I'm dying, and Mama Frances will be her mother. That was very hard for us to see, that this is the choice that is given to parents in this place. But Esther Toto asked Debbie if she would stay at the orphanage as long as she could, and so she could be with her child and possibly even help with the other children. And that was in December of 2009. In May, the well went in. Well, of course, as I told you, bringing a well changes the dynamics. It improves health because the water is clean, but it also frees people up. It gives them more time. It gives the kids time for school, although they had always made sure that happened. But there are women from the village who help with the orphans, and it gave them more time. They were able to walk to Mora, to that Fredica hospital where Anna had been born, and get medicine for Debbie. And when Anna returned in 2012, a woman came up to greet her, and she was very surprised to discover, that's Debbie. Debbie's just fine. She's getting HIV medicine regularly. She's now able to walk to Mora herself and get the medicine. She is watching her daughter, that's little Frances they call her, and she's watching Frances grow up, and she will see that child become an adult. And that's simply because of the water. And that's simply because there are people in the U.S. who said, yeah, I'll give a little money to an orphanage in Uganda. I know it's a place I'll never see. And so purchasing the book makes you a part of this cycle. This is how important it is just to give a little bit to help these people. So that's our story, and thank you so much for listening.
Honey, you have time for questions?
Could you tell the story of the title?
It's a complicated one. When Anna was a child, they would at night they would have a fire, just a little low fire, and they would roast nuts, ground nuts, which are peanuts, but they call them ground nuts, and they would roast some ground nuts at the fire, and her grandmother would sing songs, and one of the songs that she sang was about the moon in the sky and how she wished. The song goes, "How I wish humankind could be like the moon. It disappears, but it comes back. It always comes back." And there were kind of two versions of the song. One was that husbands should be more like moons, but the other was just that people should be more like moons. And so this song came into Anna's life several times at difficult points. Her mother was sick for a while and was away, and she would look at the moon and think, "My Toto must be like the moon in the sky. She will come back to me." And then through her whole life, she looked at James as the moon in her sky, but then of course James wasn't the moon in her sky. And basically, what Anna finally learned was that she could be the moon in the sky to other people. She didn't have to wait for the moon in her sky. And she is the moon in the sky for so many people. So that's where the name came from.
We got a question back here.
Did they have a warning system when these troops were coming close to them?
Have a warning system.
Did they have a warning system? Not that I know of. Really, they just every night they went out and hid. It wasn't. Oh dear, they're coming today. It was just, they'll be by. We're all going to go hide. So it was pretty much. I mean, there are other books and there's a movie about Uganda, and the people basically just lived in the bush. They really rarely returned home, and you just see them, they're out under trees. Sometimes they even had little fires where they cooked, but for the most part they were just hiding. So it was more just a constant thing.
Was that a virgin forest with the giant trees out there? Was the forest big?
You know, that's not something that I know. I've never asked Anna to describe it exactly. She always described it as just being in the bush, and I had the impression that it was more low trees and not huge forests. But I don't know that for sure. That's an interesting question. I'll have to ask her.
Is James still in Anna's life?
James passed away about 2005, but he had been very sick, and he had not really been in Anna's life for quite a while. She was still the person that when he was hospitalized, he put her name down, and so she was called that he was in the hospital, but that he was dying, and so she was able to say goodbye to him. But yeah, he just wasted away. He died here. Yeah.
What kind of support does the orphanage receive from the government of Uganda or the local governments, or maybe the churches?
None. They really do not receive support in Uganda, and I don't know. I know they are registered as a non-government organization there, but they had to do that in order for us to set up a 501c3 in this country. The government supports education for the lower grades. I don't know of any support that the government gives to orphanages. I just don't know that. As far as churches, nothing has ever come forward. This is an area of Uganda with not really large towns, and it's kind of a forgotten corner. I don't know how thoroughly Anna might have tried to seek assistance there.
So is there a possibility for adoption of those kids?
That's not Anna's goal, and Uganda is not, they're not terribly interested in having their children adopted. Anna is really very dedicated to the concept that these kids have a culture, and if she can help them get educated and stay within their own culture, they'll be better off. And I think she's right. The orphans who have grown up and gone into jobs have good jobs. They're giving to the community, and they come back and help the orphanage as well. So her goal is more to keep them there than to try to sort of farm them out. It's just not been something that she has wanted to pursue.
Over here? Yes.
Is your insight to Uganda more recently in terms of, because I think the literature, the area most of my research is on, often in Africa, and it seems like the recent literature is cited that in Uganda that the governments have established like a food rationing program whereby you see, especially among double orphans, more schooling trends, and I think it's because of the food program. That actually increases. It's more like a type of a wherever household that they're in. Does that make sense? I'm not sure if you're familiar with the program. That's what the literature is saying.
Yeah, I've read about that too. It does not seem to have reached as far as Agu, as nearly as we can tell.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions? Well, with that in mind, I want to thank very much our speaker.